After a long time, she whispered huskily, "For God's sake, don't say anything stupid. Just keep right on doing what you're doing at the moment." He obeyed, and it was she who broke the silence. Her voice was shaky. "I hope you had enough forethought to make the bunk wide enough for two." Still, he said nothing, but lifted her up in his arms and took her to see for herself. "Do you know, I didn't realize it could be like that." There was wonder in her voice as he stared down at her, leaning on one elbow. It was so good and natural and easy. She traced a fingertip over his bare chest, drawing little circles around his nipples. "I like a hairy chest," she purred. "I mean, you know, I always felt it was such a solemn thing to do after vows and declarations." "The sound of organ music," she giggled, "if you'll excuse the expression." "That's another thing," he said. "The only time I've ever heard you giggle is when you're doing it, or when you have just done it." "That's the only time I ever feel like giggling," she agreed, and giggled again. "Do be a pet and get the wine glasses." "Now, what is so funny?" he demanded from the companionway. "Your bottom is white and baby smooth. No, 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 don't cover it." While he hunted in the galley cupboard, she called from the cabin, "Do you have a tape of the pastoral?"
I think so."
"Put it on, pet."
"Why?"
"I'll tell you when you come back to bed." She was sitting at the head of the bunk, stark naked in the lotus position. He put one of the wine glasses in her hand and, after a short struggle, managed to twist his own long legs into the lotus and sat facing her.
"So tell me," he invited.
"Don't be dense, Craig. I mean, isn't that just a perfect accompaniment?" Another great storm of music and love swept over them, leaving them clinging helplessly to each other, and in the aching silence that followed, she tenderly stroked back the sweat-damp hair that had fallen into his eyes. It was too much for him. "I love you," he blurted out. "Oh, God, I love you so." Almost roughly, she pushed him aside and sat up. "You're a sweet, funny boy and a gentle, considerate lover, but you do have an ungodly talent for saying stupid things at the wrong time." In the morning, she said, "You made dinner, so I'll make breakfast," and went to the galley wearing only one of his old shirts. She had to roll the sleeves up, and the tails dangled below her knees. "You got enough eggs and bacon to open your own restaurant. Were you expecting a visitor?"
"Not expecting, but hoping," he called back from the shower. "Make mine sunny side up." After breakfast, she helped him install the big, glittering stainless steel winches on the main deck. It needed someone to hold the gusset plates in position while he drilled and bolted through from the other side.
"You're very handy, aren't you?" she said.
They had to shout at each other, for he was working below deck while she was perched on the edge of the cockpit. "It's kind of you to notice."
"So I suppose you're a first-class armourer?"
"Oh, I'm pretty good."
"Do you do what I suspect? Fix up guns?"
"Yeah, it's one of my duties."
"How can you bring yourself to do it? Guns are so evil."
"That is the typical prejudice of the ignorant and uninformed layman." He turned her own words against her. "Firearms are on one level highly functional and useful tools, and on another level they can be magnificent works of art. Man has always lavished some of his most creative instincts on his weapons."
"But the way men use them," she protested.
"For instance, they were used to prevent Adolf Hitler gassing the entire Jewish nation," he pointed out.
"Oh, come on, Craig. What are they being used for out here, in the bush, at this very moment?"
"Guns aren't evil, but some of the men who use them are. You could say the same thing about spanners."
He tightened the bolts on the winch and stuck his head out of the hatch.
"Oh, that's enough for today. On the seventh day he rested, so how about a beer?"
Craig had rigged a speaker in the cockpit, and they lolled in the sun and drank beer and listened to the music.
"Look, Jan, I don't know how tactful a way to put this, but I don't want you seeing anyone else.
Do
you know what I mean?
There you go again. Her eyes slanted and crackled like blue ice. Do shut up, Craig.
I mean, after what's happened between us. He ploughed on doggedly. I think we should...
Look, dear boy, you have a choice. Make me mad again or make me giggle again. What's it going to be?
At lunchtime on Monday, she came up to police headquarters, and they ate his ham sandwiches while he showed her around the armory. And despite herself, she was intrigued by the exhibits of captured weapons and explosives. He explained the operation of the various types of mines and how they could be detected and disarmed. You have to hand it to the Turs, Craig admitted. The swine carry those things on their backs 200 miles or so through the bush. Just try and pick that up and you'll see what I mean. At last, he took her through to a small back room. This is my special project. It's called T&I, Trace and Identify. He gestured at the charts that covered the walls and the big boxes of empty cartridge cases piled beside the workbench. After each contact with the Turs, our armourers sweep the area and pick up every used cartridge. Firstly, they are checked for fingerprints. So if the Tur has a record, then we can identify him immediately. If he has polished his rounds before loading, or if we have no record of his fingerprints, we can still trace exactly which rifle fired the cartridge. He led her to the bench and let her look into the low-power microscope that stood on it. The firing pin in each rifle strikes an indentation into the cap of the cartridge, which is as individual as a fingerprint. We can follow the career of each active Tur in the field. We can make accurate estimates of how many there are and which are the hot ones.
The hot ones? She looked up from the microscope.
Out of every 100 Turs in the field, 90 or so of them hole up in good cover near a village which can supply them with food and young girls. And they try to keep out of danger and contact with our forces. But the hot ones are different. They are the tigers, the fanatics, the killers. These charts show their first team. He led her to the wall. Look at this one. We call him Primrose because his firing pin leaves a mark like a flower. He's been in the bush for 3 years and been in contact 96 times. That is almost once every 10 days. He must be made of steel. Craig ran his finger down the chart. Here's another. We call him Leopard Paw. You can see why by the print of his rifle. He's a newcomer. His first time across the river. But he hit 4 farms and ran an ambush. Then he went into contact with Rowley's scouts. Not many of them survived that. Rowley's boys are incredible. They wiped out most of the cadre. But Leopard Paw fought like a veteran and got away with a bunch of his men. Rowley's combat report says he lost 4 men to AP mines that Leopard Paw put down as he ran, and another 6 in the actual fighting. 10 men. That's the heaviest casualties the scouts have ever taken in any one contact. Craig tapped the name on the chart. He's a hot one. We're going to hear more of this lad.
Jeanine shuddered. It's awful, all this death and suffering. When will it ever end?
It started when man first stood up on his hind legs. It's not going to end tomorrow. Now, let's talk about dinner tonight. I'll pick you up at your flat at 7, okay? She telephoned him at the armory a little before 5 o'clock.
Craig, don't come for me this evening.
Why not?
I won't be there.
Well, what's happened?
Rowley is back from the bush.
Craig did a little work on the foredeck of the yacht, placing the cleats for the jib sheets. But when it was too dark, he went below and wandered around disconsolately. She had left her dark glasses on the table beside the bunk and a lipstick on the edge of the wash basin. The saloon still smelled of her perfume, and the 2 wine glasses stood together in the sink. I think I'll get drunk, he decided. But he had no tonic, and gin with plain water tasted awful. He tipped it into the sink and put the pastoral on the tape. But the images it conjured up were too painful. He hit the stop button. He picked Sir Ralph's leather-bound journal off the table and flicked through it. He had read it twice. He should have gone out to King's Lynn at the weekend. Bawu would have been expecting him to come for the next journal in the series. He started to read it again, and it was an immediate opiate for the loneliness. After a while, he searched in the drawer of the chart table and found the ruled exercise book which he had used for drawing the layout of the cabins and galley. He tore out the used pages, and there were still over 100 unused sheets. He sat down at the saloon table with an HB pencil from the navigation set and stared at the first empty sheet for almost 5 minutes. Then he wrote, "Africa, crouched low on the horizon, like a lion in ambush, tawny and gold in the early sunlight, seared by the cold of the Benguela current." Robin Ballantyne stood by the ship's rail and stared towards it. Craig reread what he'd written and felt a strange excitement, something he'd never experienced before. He could actually see the young woman. He could see the way she stood with her chin lifted eagerly and the wind snapping and tangling her hair. The pencil started to race across the empty page, and the woman moved in his mind and spoke aloud in his ears. He turned the page and wrote on. Then, almost before he realized it, the exercise book was filled with his pointed, peaky handwriting, and outside the porthole, by his head, the day was lightning. Ever since Janine Carpenter could remember, there had always been horses in her father's stables at the back of the veterinary dispensary. When she was 8, her father had taken her out for the first time with the local hunt. Just after her 22nd birthday, a few months before she had left home for Africa, she had been awarded her hunt buttons. The mount that Roland Ballantyne had given her was a beautiful chestnut filly without any other marking. She was curried to a gloss so that she shone in the sunlight like wet red silk. Janine had ridden her often before. She was fleet and strong, and there was an accord between them. Roland rode his stallion. It was an enormous black beast he called Mzilikazi, after the old king. The veins stood out under the skin of his shoulders and belly like living serpents. The great black bunch of his testicles was crudely and overpoweringly masculine. When he laid back his ears and bared his teeth, the mucous membrane in the corners of his savage eyes was the colour of blood. There was an arrogance and menace in him that frightened Janine, and yet excited her also. Horses and rider were of a pair. Roland Ballantyne wore brown whipcord breeches and high boots, boned to a glossy perfection. The short sleeves of the crisp white shirt were stretched tightly across his hard, smooth muscle on his upper arms. Janine was certain that he always wore white to contrast against the deep tan of his face and arms. She thought he was impossibly handsome, and that cruel and ruthless streak in him made him all the more attractive than mere good looks alone could ever do. Last night in the bed in her bachelor flat, she had asked him, "How many men have you killed?" "As many as necessary," he had replied. And though she thought that she hated war and death and suffering, it excited her in a way she could not control. Afterwards he had laughed easily and said, "You're a kinky little bitch, did you know that?" She had hated him for understanding, and she had been desperately ashamed, and so angry that she had gone for his eyes with her nails. He had held her down effortlessly, and still chuckling, he had whispered in her ear until she lost control again. Now, when she looked up at him riding beside her, she felt the lingering fear of him, and the goose flesh on her arms, and the hard ball of excitement in the pit of her stomach. They rode up to the top of the hills, and he reined the stallion down. It danced in a tight little circle, picking up its hooves delicately, and tried to nuzzle her filly. But Roland pulled its head away and pointed at the horizons that fell away into blue distances in every direction. "Everything you can see from here, every blade of grass, every grain of earth, all of it belongs to the Ballantynes. We fought for it, we won it. It's ours, and anybody who wants to take it from us will have to kill me first." The idea of anyone or anything doing that was ludicrous. He was a young god, one of the immortals. He dismounted and led the horses to one of the tall masasa trees. He tied them and then reached up and lifted her down from the saddle. He walked her to the edge of the precipice and held her against him, her back to his chest, so that she could look out and see it all. "There it is," he said. "Just look at it." It was beautiful. Rich golden grasslands and graceful trees, waters that flowed in the small clear streams or shone like mirrors
where the dam walls held them back, the tranquil herds of big red cattle, as red as the rich earth beneath their hooves, and arched above it all the high, cloud-dappled blue of the African sky. "It needs a woman to love it as I love it," he said. "A woman to breed fine sons to cherish it, to hold it as I will hold it." She knew what he was going to say then. And now that it was about to happen, she felt numbed and confused. She felt herself beginning to tremble against him. "I want you to be that woman," Roland Ballantyne said. And she began to weep uncontrollably.